This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 14th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, does the EU need an army?
It's so unrealistic. To get the kind of thing that he seems to be talking about up and running is going to take 5 to 10 years.
Also ahead.
This has a certain sort of aspect of knee-jerk petulance about it. But on the other hand, what it could do is open up a debate in Sweden about the merits of making and selling arms and the things that you sacrifice in order to do that.
Strained relations between Saudi Arabia and Sweden. After a spat over the end of an arms agreement and the souring of diplomatic relations, we hear the view from the guests who joined us this week on Midori House. All that and much, much more besides coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. Now, Monday was time to talk military matters here on Monocle 24. That day on The Briefing, we asked, does the EU need its own army? In an interview published last weekend in Germany's Welt am Sonntag newspaper, Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the European Commission, said a common European army would convey to Russia that we are serious about defending the values of the European Union. But the British were hardly thrilled at the idea. A UK government spokesperson stressed that defence is a national responsibility and there's no prospect of a European army. Tom Edwards spoke with Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper.
For a long time, this notion of a common foreign and security policy has been on the table, that the EU took over military responsibilities from a thing called the Western European Union. And frankly, it hasn't got terribly far. They set down a whole lot of tasks which were supposed to be realised and they should be up and running more or less by 3 years ago. But it never really happened. And unfortunately, in real hard power terms, and by the way, this is the issue, and I think that this is where Europe has really lost the plot, whether it's Juncker, Mrs. Merkel, or David Cameron, that they do not understand where hard power fits in this highly complex spectrum. And somebody who really does seem to have a notion of it in his version of hybrid warfare is Vladimir Putin. But what Juncker is saying is for European credibility, we've got to substitute NATO in giving protection to our members in Eastern Europe, not only the Baltics, but also the Scandinavians, Poland and the Balkans. And this doesn't wash. It's so unrealistic. To get the kind of thing that he seems to be talking about up and running is going to take 5 to 10 years.
What about, I guess some people would say, well, hang on, actually, there's an intuitive point here, which is that, you know, we're seeing rollbacks. We had reports out last week about a number of European countries who are not increasing or maintaining their defence spending at the level to which they previously committed. Even just here in Great Britain, we've got a significant number of troops that could be leaving that could be leaving the military, 15,000 just during the next parliament. Surely this is quite a sensible idea, isn't it, to try and share the load? Or do you think it's a matter of principle for some of the politicians in Westminster?
We do it very badly. Look at the Franco-German Corps, which was supposed to be the element of this thing. It didn't really happen. It's going to take a different mindset. But what is problematic about it with all this cuts, and cuts are in the air and they will continue, and wait for the Friday surprise, the Black Swan, the 9/11, or whatever that comes out. Because the one thing that I was hinting earlier, what the assessment I think is very poor, and actually I find very, very worrying, whether at national and international level, is assessing threat and the efficacy of hard power. Now, the man who invented hard power, soft power, smart power spectrum, Joe Nye, has got a new book out about why the 21st century America will still be top dog because it can manage hard, soft and economic power together. What the European leadership does not understand is that there is a certain kind of threat. If you feel it is so important and you have to thwart it, you have to confront it, but you have to confront it with the ability to fight. It's the ability to fight. It is just not in the lexicon of the Cameron leadership, for example. The French are much more prepared to get stuck in, as it were, quite frighteningly so. But look what's happening in Chad, in Mali, and so on, that they're the ones who are really effectively projecting power. UK used to be able to do it to the same degree of the French, but it has completely lost the intellectual capacity to grasp the how, where, and when it's needed.
That was Tom Edwards speaking to Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard newspaper, on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, staying with defence and security, we turn now to Japan. The kidnapping and murder of two hostages from that country earlier this year drew attention to the fact that Japan's getting ever more involved in international conflicts of all sorts, whether it wants to or not. On Monday, we focused on news that it's now considering the creation of an overseas intelligence agency, similar to the UK's MI6. That day on The Globalist, Emma Nelson spoke with Alessio Patilano, Asian defence expert at the Department of War Studies, King's College London.
We're starting to see the final signals of a process that started a few years back. A discussion in Japan about the need to create a stronger intelligence organisation, in particular insofar as overseas information. So not just information from within Japan for counterintelligence or to counter potential terrorist threats from within, but also to actually start gathering information in areas where Japanese interests exist. So this is a discussion that has been ongoing for quite some time. And it is becoming now, we're coming to crunch time, to that moment where the discussion is starting to take form. So these organizations would probably take the shape of any other military information gathering intelligence that operates outside the national borders.
When you describe it in those terms, one wonders why a department like this is not already in existence. To what degree is the sort of pacifist, anti-interventionist constitutional heart of Japan being questioned here?
Well, I think here what we are talking about is a different type of intelligence. So you're absolutely right. The key question is why this is happening just now. And that's because military intelligence, as in sort of threat perception to national security, was up until recently focusing just on those areas that were directly connected to the defense of the Japanese archipelago. So the Japanese, for example, have a very good signal intelligence activity and monitoring of activities, anything that happens within the maritime and air spaces around the island of Japan. But this is very sort of low level tactical and operational kind of intelligence that is directly connected to the defense of the archipelago. Now, the point that you're making about the constitution, how much this engages with the constitution, I think that's exactly the core point that this organization will have to sort of wrestle with. Because what we're talking about is not just gaining tactical and operational and military intelligence that threatens the archipelago. We're trying to build up a picture that allows for a better understanding beyond the strict national borders. But again, this is part of this bigger debate in Japan of the past 15 years. Where does defence end?
Where defence ends was questioned quite profoundly when Kenji Goto and Haruna Yukawa were executed, well, beheaded by Islamic State. Did that, Alessio, prompt a public drive? There was an awful lot of criticism at the time for the way Shinzo Abe handled the crisis. Do you think that this announcement about the equivalent of an MI6 is perhaps a popular response?
Emma, you're absolutely right. And part of that is a response to that feeling, that public feeling that something more should have been done. And I think it connects directly to a very important point, that is Japan's NGOs and private companies have interests that are on a global scale. And in particular, the Middle East has always been a very important source of oil, and both in terms of aid, funds that to assist local population, as well as the presence of NGOs, so the Japanese nationals in this region and in many others in that respect, to provide humanitarian assistance, very much something that is the brainchild of this post-war pacifist spirit. It's becoming a reality that in a world that has so many different type of threats, even the government must do something in terms of building a picture that allows to act more quickly if there's a crisis hitting any one of them.
That was Alessio Patilano, Asian defence expert at the Department of War Studies, King's College London, talking to Emma Nelson on Monday's edition of The Globalist. Up next, we'll take a look at the ever-strained diplomatic relationship between Australia and Indonesia.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now to a story that continued to grab headlines worldwide this week and to which we turned on Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. Recent years have hardly been a golden era for Australian-Indonesian relations, but they've worsened in recent months over Indonesia's intention to execute two Australian men convicted of drug smuggling. The men are members of the so-called Bali Nine. Convicted in 2005, they've been in jail for almost 10 years. Australia's pleas for mercy and proposals for a prisoner swap seem to have fallen on deaf ears. The two are expected to face a firing squad. On Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Victoria Graham and Andrew Muller talked over the latest with former European correspondent for The Australian, Peter Wilson.
They may or may not do what Brazil and the Netherlands did recently and withdraw their ambassador. There have been some hints lately that they won't do that, but there'll certainly be repercussions in a lot of other areas. I think you'll see political visits cancelled, some military police cooperation programs deferred or cancelled. It's the sort of tit-for-tat thing that Australia and Indonesia have been doing to each other for decades, because the Indonesians have made it clear that they will respond. They're feeling very bullish about this, very, very aggressive.
Is that because of Joko Widodo, do you think?
And yes, and his whole cabinet. I mean, he is the most populist leader Indonesia's had for quite a while, and there's a strong public opinion about this. The Indonesians think that the Australians are racist and patronising. You know, that's a lot of Indonesian people think that. There was a, you know, quite a colourful response after Tony Abbott played the money card, saying, well, we did give you $1 billion during the tsunami, $1 billion of aid. How about, you know, paying us back now? And a Muslim youth group went around asking people for coins to give money back to the Australians, and they turned up with 5 bags of coins at the Australian embassy and handed it over, saying, here you go if you want your money back. So, you know, there is strong public feeling there and political feeling. I mean, Mr. Tejo, the Minister for Political, Legal and Security Affairs, has said that if the Australians keep annoying the Indonesians over this and do something sharp afterwards, then, quote, we will surely let the illegal immigrants go to Australia. If they are let to go to Australia, it'll be like a human tsunami.
Mr. Tejo is what is colloquially known as a colourful politician, though.
He
may not actually be speaking for the powers that be. I'm just wondering, what you talk about public opinion in Indonesia and how strong that is. What's your sense of how it's actually running in Australia? Because Tony Abbott, and I'm not somebody who is generally sympathetic towards him, but is in a weird position in that he, as Prime Minister of Australia, and given Australia stands against capital punishment, he is obliged to stand up for two Australian citizens on death row. Drug smugglers, by and large, though, struggle for sympathy among the Australian public.
They do. This is one of those occasions when we've got to look at Tony Abbott the person too, because he is a very strong Catholic. He's got strong personal feelings about the death penalty. So he's not faking it when he says, you know, he doesn't want this to happen. It causes a lot of political problems. Personal political problems for him. He has gone further than any previous Australian Prime Minister in bigging up the importance of the relationship with Indonesia. Paul Keating said it was that no other relationship was more important. He said that in 1994. Tony Abbott has said it is our most important relationship. Now, that's a big call. You know, America is pretty important to Australia. China, Japan, there are other countries, Britain, you know, there are countries around that are pretty important to Australia. And the particular political investment Tony Abbott has is that he got elected promising to stop the boats, to stop asylum seekers being able to sail to Australia. And that depends on Indonesia. So if he really does blow his relationship with Indonesians here, there's a big personal political price for him to pay.
That was Peter Wilson, former European correspondent for The Australian, talking to Victoria Graham and Andrew Muller on the Monocle Daily here at Midori House on Tuesday. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. Now time to discuss copyright and creativity. This week, the world's ears pricked up to compare Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye with Blurred Lines, the 2013 track from Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke. A jury in Los Angeles sided with Gaye's estate in ruling that his song had been plagiarised by Thicke and Williams for their hit single. On Wednesday's edition of The Briefing, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck looked into that story with music writer Dorian Linsky.
It's quite hard to make sense of the jury's decision here because the judge instructed them to regard the two songs as they appeared on sheet music, so as you might play them on guitar or piano, not the sound of the records. And on that level, you know, on the level of kind of melodies and chords, the songs are not the same. And sonically, they are similar because it was meant as a homage. But if we're talking about things that are sonically similar, that kind of the number of potential lawsuits is just astronomical, because that's one thing that songwriters do. You know, they have a conversation with the past.
Well, Dorian, let's have a quick... This is a bit of a mashup of the two, and we'll allow our audience as well to see what they think.
Everybody get up.
Well, Dorian, obviously a bit of a party vibe going on in both, which kind of doesn't help with the kind of the blurred lines, as it were. But when you listen to those two, do you still feel that there's a distinctive enough element that, you know, in a way this case may be appealed?
Absolutely. I mean, I expect it to be appealed, and I hope that the next jury has a little more understanding of how songwriting works, because, you know, when I hear those two records play together, it seems like a clash. Even tonally, they're different. There is a party vibe, but they're very tonally different. The Blurred Lines is more playful, kind of more sleazy, more jaunty. The Marvin Gaye song is kind of is quite sinuous and sensual. So even the tone of the records is different. And I know that people pointed out, for example, the use of cowbell, and Pharrell Williams, who produced Blurred Lines and wrote most of it, has used cowbell on countless productions. You know, if anything, he could sometimes be accused of plagiarising himself.
That was music writer Dorian Linsky talking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck on Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. Now to a subject altogether more serious. On Wednesday, we turned to Sweden, where a diplomatic row with Saudi Arabia seemed to be growing. Earlier this week, Sweden confirmed the end of a decade-long arms agreement with Saudi Arabia after the Saudis blocked the Swedish foreign minister from speaking about human rights at an Arab leaders' summit. And in the latest update on that story, come Wednesday's edition of Midori House, Saudi Arabia announced it was recalling its ambassador from Stockholm due to Sweden's remarks over human rights and democracy. Well, that day on the program, Steve Bloomfield unpicked the story with Mary Dajewski, chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent here in the UK, and Sebastian Borger, London's correspondent for Berliner Zeitung.
I think there is a degree of naivete there, because you do sort of think that if making weapons and hardware is what you're good at, and Sweden is rather good at it, as indeed the British are rather good at it too, that it's something where you go out and you look for markets and you sell. But I'm sure there are going to be, just to be extremely parochial, I'm sure there are going to be very many people in Britain who are going to look across with envious eyes at Sweden and say, how come is this the advantage of being a small country that can uphold certain principles? Whereas if you're a bigger country like Britain, where you aspire maybe to play a bigger part on the world stage, you have to say you feel that you sacrifice certain principles. You cannot imagine the British government turning around and saying, because, say, a government minister, a female minister also, it has to be said, was not going to be asked to speak in public in Saudi Arabia, that we would cancel any sort of contract with Saudi Arabia.
The British government lowers the flag when the Saudi king dies over Westminster Abbey, of all places.
And there was a huge fuss about that. I mean, I remember walking down Whitehall and wondering why on earth the flags were at half mast, because there didn't seem to be any reason for it. And then we were told, well, when a foreign monarch dies, this is to do with having a monarchy rather than having to do with a special relationship with Saudi. But you do rather ask questions about it.
Just to turn back to Sweden for a moment, Sebastian. It's, you know, as Mary says, maybe, you know, Sweden can decide, we're a small country, we can do this. But I've seen Sweden's former foreign minister Carl Bildt today has been saying, well, look, actually, you know, we're losing jobs at Ericsson. You know, we can't afford to lose jobs in our defence industry as well. There is going to be, you know, an argument within Sweden that, look, this is all very well, us standing up and saying we don't like this, but there are people in this country who rely on this for jobs.
As Mary was pointing out, that's the reality of the situation. And in that sense, it is particularly interesting that it's a social democrat government, which traditionally, at least, has been allied with the unions in Sweden as anywhere else. It comes across as slightly sort of a policy made on the hoof.
I want to ask you about this. In fact, Mary, maybe you can answer this one. It's, you know, it would be one thing if the new social democratic government had come into power and said, right, we are reviewing all sales of arms to dictatorships. And if we feel that this doesn't follow our principles, then we will, you know, we'll revoke all these deals. And then this, which is a bit like, well, you know, we tried to talk about human rights, they wouldn't let us, so therefore, you know, tough.
Yes, I mean, this has a certain sort of aspect of knee-jerk petulance about it. But on the other hand, what it could do is open up a debate in Sweden of the sort that other countries would really, really like to have about the merits of making and selling arms and the things that you sacrifice in order to do that. And the jobs issue will obviously come into that. But I think if you were going to have a public debate about it, you know, this is something that I think Britain could do with one of those debates too.
Yeah, but genuinely, I think within the European Union, you know, you'd have a lot more clout in worldwide if you could agree on a position together where you at least find some criteria when you want to sell arms and when not.
That was Sebastian Burger, London's correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Mary Dejewski, chief editorial writer and a columnist at The Independent here in the UK. They were talking to Steve Bloomfield on Wednesday's edition of Midori House.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like Hindenburg paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Welcome back to The Recap. Now, last week on The Recap, you heard us cover the murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. And this week, after a former Chechen police officer admitted to being part of his murder, suspicions grew of a political cover-up. The stink of conspiracy continues too, with new claims from the Kremlin's human rights watchdog suggesting he was tortured into a confession. Zaur Dadaev remains in prison. To discuss the latest twist in the investigation, Tyge Enright was joined on Friday's Globalist by the director of the Russia Studies Centre at the Henry Jackson Society, Andrew Foxall.
First of all, the allegations of torture come as very little surprise. The Russian police and the state, they serve a very little credibility and transparency. And the abuse of prisoners in Russian prisons, in the Russian prison system, including in pretrial detention where these suspects are being held, is absolutely rampant. You know, rampant to the extent that complaints relating to the torture of individuals in Russian jails takes up something like a third of the cases before the European Court of Human Rights. You know, really is so very commonplace. It's more the rule rather than the exception. Where the council itself is concerned, you know, it's really a relic of a former age. It was, one could really think of it as being almost entirely independent up until 2012, when President Putin came back to power, and as part of that broader crackdown on political and civil liberties, he'd started to take it under his control. And nevertheless, it does still do some genuine, free and fair work. And there's this suggestion that although Putin took it under his control, he didn't take it under his full control, so as that it wouldn't be tarred with the brush of being one of his puppets, in a sense. The recent report does raise some very important questions about the Nemtsov assassination. You know, it argues that, as you say, that Tsar Dudayev, the chief suspect, was tortured into giving his confession, that the two other people, the Gubashevs, who are Dudayev's cousins, were tortured and also being detained, and that another individual arrested at the same time as Dudayev has simply gone missing.
What impact has this murder had on support for the opposition?
Very little, I think. The murder, of course, came literally days before the big opposition rally was planned in Moscow on March 1st. In a sense, rather than an opposition rally, what then took place was a sort of funeral parade for Nemtsov. So 30, 50,000 individuals on the streets of Moscow showing their support for Nemtsov. It has certain members of the Russian opposition, for example, Alexei Navalny, have sort of come out fighting and swinging, made some very important statements, quite sort of bellicose rhetoric, you know, we won't let Nemtsov's death be in vain sort of thing. But in reality, you know, these groups are pretty marginal, and Kremlin and Vladimir Putin in particular controls, give or take, everything that's said, read, thought by the Russian population.
Well, indeed, on that point, and I suppose you're not going to read it in most Russian newspapers, but, you know, has there been any actual evidence or theories produced or anything that would actually back up the, I suppose, popular Western theory that it was the Kremlin what done it?
An interesting question. In terms of evidence, very little, but in part that's because the Russian authorities themselves have said and given out very little evidence to support this. Certainly the when the suspects appeared in the Moscow courtroom on Sunday, this was simply, you know, do you plead guilty, yes or no, rather than any providing of evidence. I do think, however, that in one respect it defies belief that Nemtsov could have been assassinated so close to the Kremlin. Probably one of, if not the most surveilled area on the face of the earth, without somebody within the state structures knowing that there was a plan afoot.
That was Andrew Foxall of the Henry Jackson Society speaking to Tyge Enright on The Globalist on Friday. Well, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Alice Block and Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.